the United States versus Bueno. Ms. Pavlo?
May it please the court, counsel. Morning. My name is Susan Pavlo. I represent Oscar Bueno. In this case, the district court denied Mr. Bueno's motion to suppress without an evidentiary hearing, and one of the reasons the court did so was based on the collective knowledge doctrine. The motion was filed in this case, and a report of Trooper Owen, who conducted the stop of the vehicle along with his squad car video, was submitted. Both the report and the video indicate that it was a routine traffic stop, that Trooper Owen was on patrol, observed a car speeding, and believed that he developed some probable cause for a prolonged detention. In responding in the district court, the government submitted an argument that the trooper curbed the vehicle at the behest of the DEA. The problem with the argument is that there's no factual support for it. Trooper Owen's report has no mention of being asked to curb that vehicle by the DEA. It has no mention of any prior contact he had with the DEA agent. There's no affidavit submitted by either Trooper Owen or someone from the DEA indicating that the DEA asked Trooper Owen to curb that vehicle. Without that evidentiary link, it's merely speculative. The cases on the collective knowledge doctrine indicate that while a lot of information doesn't have to be conveyed from one agency to the next in order to impute the knowledge, there does have to be some type of communication, whether it be officers attended a briefing or merely received a phone call from an agency saying, hey, can you pull this car over? So while it doesn't have to be a lot of information, there does have to be some type of communication in order for the knowledge of the DEA to be imputed to a trooper who's going to curb the vehicle.
In this case, I guess one of the concerns I have, Ms. Pavlo, is it looks like you're looking for a hearing on whether Trooper Owen was just incredibly lucky to have stopped the one van that had $2.7 million in drug proceeds, or got an instruction from the DEA who happened to be nearby. I mean, I hear those facts, and I can make a well-educated guess, at least, as to which is more likely.
Your Honor, respectfully, a guess wouldn't be enough to, I believe, make the evidentiary leak. I don't think the speculation is enough. I mean, certainly officers, I don't know that I would describe it as luck. I mean, officers are on routine patrol all the time. And a lot of times routine stops, do blossom into recovery of drugs or guns or, in this case, cash. I don't know that it's extreme luck, and I think it's speculative, quite frankly, to assume that that's the case. That's one of the reasons a hearing would be necessary in this case. And based on the cases for the collective knowledge doctrine and the lack of evidentiary support in this record, I believe a hearing would be necessary to resolve that particular dispute. In addition, the district court indicated that the consent of the co-defendant as well as the canine alert added to the propriety of the stop. The canine alert and the consent certainly can allow the officers to continue to detain that vehicle and search it, but it doesn't justify continuing to detain Mr. Bueno. When they conduct the search of the vehicle, They don't discover any guns. They don't discover any drugs. They don't even discover the money. They discover, according to Trooper Owen's report, some package that he suspects is contraband. They don't open the package. Instead, they place Mr. Bueno into handcuffs. They place him in the back of a squad car. They transport him. He's in custody at that point. They transport him to the police station, and the last thing you see on the video is him walking away into the station in handcuffs. There is no basis for his custody at that point. Nothing illegal has been discovered. And for that reason, his detention was long overdue. It was unduly prolonged. There was no reasonable basis to extend that very routine traffic stop into what amounted to over, I believe, 30 or 40 minutes that he remained in custody.
Can I ask you a couple of quick questions, Ms. Pavlo? Would you agree that if the collective knowledge doctrine applies, then the police had a sufficient basis to detain the vehicle, search the vehicle, and detain Mr. Bueno?
No, because I think what the hearing is also going to need to develop is the type of probable cause. The government submitted the affidavit in support of complaint, and while that certainly lays out a lot of probable cause for the co-defendant in this case, the co-defendant was on the wiretaps, the co-defendant was under surveillance, Mr. Bueno doesn't really pop up in that affidavit until he's seen loading some boxes into a van. I believe that's what the affidavit in support of complaint says. So that is he merely present with Mr. Flores? He is at that point, but I don't know that that then would be enough probable cause to distinguish his mere presence versus the belief that he's participating in illegal activity. And that's, again, one of the things that the district court, I think, would have to assess at a hearing.
You're in your rebuttal time, you know.
I will reserve the rebuttal time. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Mullins?
May it please the court, my name is Brian Mullins, and I represent Jose Gonzalez-Zavala on this appeal. Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala received a 40-year sentence. His guideline base level was 43, which is the highest possible base offense level under the sentencing guidelines. And that level was largely driven by the quantity of drugs involved, but it was also driven to a significant part by two enhancements that he received. One was for engaging in a pattern of criminal conduct as a livelihood, and the other was for maintaining premises as a stash house, essentially. And he did not dispute those enhancements that were recommended by the pre-sentence report, although he did not agree to the enhancements as part of a plea agreement because Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala entered a blind plea. So the court is reviewing for plain error, but we believe that Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala shows plain error on both of those enhancements. With respect to engaging in criminal conduct as a livelihood, the government did not meet its burden to show by preponderance of evidence that this enhancement should apply. Specifically, the term engaged in as a livelihood has a definite meaning under the guidelines. Section 2D1.1 sub B sub 14 sub E refers to guideline 4B1.3, which is the criminal livelihood guideline, and that guideline defines engaged in as a livelihood as deriving income from the pattern of criminal conduct that in any 12-month period exceeded 2,000 times the then-existing hourly minimum wage under federal law. So there is a very specific definition of what it means to engage in criminal conduct as a livelihood, and there was no effort by the government or the probation office to specify the net profit that Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala received. And this court has held in Lee versus United States that net profit is the relevant inquiry for determining whether the criminal livelihood enhancement should apply. Here there was an assumption that because there was a lot of money and a lot of cocaine involved in this case, that Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala must have received 2,000 times the then existing minimum wage, although that term and that reference to the definition was never referred to by the probation office or by the district court.
Did the PSR show any other employment or income?
The PSR said that he was engaged in lawn work, gardening work. That was not verified. And Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala reported $500 income per month in that work.
So, yes, how much work is the district court supposed to do on these issues when the defendant doesn't object?
Well, I think the government needs to at least present some evidence of what Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala received as net profit. And this could be produced by statements by co-conspirators, by direct evidence of perhaps money found on Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala's person. Cash in particular would, I think, show that the money probably came from drug sources. But I think some direct evidence rather than just, well, he dealt a lot of drugs, therefore he must have received a net profit over 2,000 times the minimum wage. I think something more than just that needs to be shown. And also, there is contrary evidence that the motive for the La Familia organization was to sell drugs here in the United States and then distribute the drugs or distribute the proceeds in Mexico. And the government stated that several times in the change of plea hearing and at the sentencing hearing, and specifically there was reference to Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala having contact with a courier who he would give the cash to, and then he would transport the cash back to Mexico. So there's just no suggestion of what Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala received for his part in this. Of course, presumably he received something, but it could have been a place to live. It could have been something, perhaps safety for his family in Mexico. There are all sorts of, I think, considerations that Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala could have received other than money. And the guideline specifically defines 2,000 times the minimum wage as what it means to engage in his livelihood. With respect to
assume for a second that there was insufficient evidence of this criminal involvement. In light of the comments by the district judge about what he thought the conduct of this defendant could justify, do we have it in our discretion to conclude that the sentence as it stands, since it isn't a life sentence, arguably?
I think that's a distinction without a difference in many ways.
I appreciate the enormity of the sentence. Would that at all suggest, because the district judge was so strong in his view of the criminality here over, 18? I guess the defendant acknowledged an 18-month period, something like that.
Correct.
That in effect, I don't want to say it's harmless, but wouldn't merit sending it back.
Well, the court reviews for plain error, and in the sentencing context, the question is whether the sentence would have been different but for the error. And I think it's fair to say that if the guideline range, without the two enhancements, the guideline range would have been 324 months to 405. With one enhancement, not the other, it's 360 to life.
Yeah, that's why I focused on the one. Suppose you are successful in convincing us as to the one but not the other.
Well, I think the district court did not give the life sentence, which is what the guidelines called for.
But actually spoke in terms of a life sentence, didn't he?
He did, and said that it's reserved for the worst of the worst and that Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala did not fall into that category. So he wanted to give him some light at the end of the tunnel. But I think that when you're looking at the fairness and integrity of the proceeding, which the court must do, and I think given the enormous length of the sentence, I think there's a higher burden that the district court needs to meet. And even a relatively, in the scheme of things, a two-level enhancement, I suppose, is not the most significant issue that the court might see. But I think in the context of a 40-year sentence, even a two-year or a two-level enhancement is significant enough that it warrants reversal if it's incorrect. And I will reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Mullen. Mr. Owens?
May it please the Court, Counsel. Good morning. My name is Derek Owens, and I represent the United States. The District Court, in this case, properly denied Defendant Bueno's motion to suppress because, in this case, the stop of co-defendant Flores' vehicle was supported by probable cause. That probable cause was shown in multiple ways. First, through the facts collectively known by law enforcement officers that Bueno and Flores were actively involved in transporting drug proceeds from Chicago to Mexico in the vehicle that was stopped. And also, through the observations of the state trooper at the time of the stop, when he observed a traffic violation that gave rise to probable cause, as well as his observations that Bueno and Flores were engaged in the transportation of illegal contraband. Additionally, after Defendant Bueno gave his consent to the trooper to continue the investigation, Flores then gave consent to search his van. Additionally,
Could you address the collective knowledge issue and specifically the question of what evidence was before the district judge that Trooper Owen was acting on instructions from or information from the DEA?
The affidavit of DEA agent Baumgartner, which was submitted with the motion, paragraph 8G has a statement that on April 16th, the day of the stop, based on wire interceptions as well as surveillance, physical surveillance, law enforcement officers seized approximately $2.6 million in U.S. currency that was being transported by Flores. That's in paragraph 8G, and that references to paragraphs 276 through 297 of that same affidavit, which sets out the surveillance, the wiretaps, and eventually the surveillance to I-57, where he was eventually stopped by Trooper Owen.
And where's the linkage in the communications between DEA and the trooper?
There is no specific language that there was a specific communication made from the DEA to the trooper.
Okay. So why isn't that a question that should be addressed at a short hearing before the district judge?
Well, in this case, the district judge found that the evidence from the affidavit was sufficient to make that finding, to make that inference that the language that says based on this surveillance.
Right, but when the defendant is saying, look, I don't believe that, I want to dispute that, and there's no direct evidence when presumably this should be easy to produce, right?
Yes.
And you guys didn't produce it. I don't understand why not, frankly, and why we're having this debate.
I agree it's not part of the record below, Your Honor. However, the district court can make that inference based on what is in the record.
Without a hearing?
It can if it finds that there is no dispute of material fact, meaning it would change the outcome either way.
Okay, so what the district court is facing is a record of silence and circumstantial evidence. And you're saying the district court should then make that finding as undisputed without a hearing. We don't do that in civil cases.
The defendant's challenge to the affidavit and the facts that were presented to the district court were made more a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence, not whether that communication was actually made.
I'm not following you.
The defendant argued, the defendant's position in the district court was essentially that the government didn't put forth sufficient evidence to support the collective knowledge doctrine.
Right, then the burden's on you to show that, right?
Absolutely, yes. Okay. And in this case, we presented evidence that, based on the physical surveillance as well as the wire interception and the surveillance up to I-57, and then the subsequent stop by the trooper on I-57, that was sufficient to meet our burden to establish the collective knowledge doctrine.
Now, I'm trying to think. In immigration cases, by comparison, this may be a little bit off the wall, but in immigration cases, immigration judges find all the time that a party who has a burden of proof who doesn't produce available corroborating evidence should not be believed. Okay? And here, the corroborating evidence, I would think, would be very easy from Trooper Owen or from somebody in the DEA saying, yeah, we told Owens to keep an eye on that van, and if he found any cause for a stop, to do it. And that would be perfectly okay, and it's not there.
That's true, Your Honor. Beyond what we have in the affidavit is the report of Trooper Owen, which describes DEA agent Hansen, who was there at the scene, coincidentally, maybe, but
yeah, right.
he was there at the scene and participated in the search.
Later. That doesn't justify the original stop, right? And it took a while till Hansen got there, right?
The record is not clear on when Hansen actually arrived at the scene. However, either way, the probable cause for the stop was established, if not by the collective knowledge doctrine, by the fact that he was speeding. He was exceeding the speed limit, which is adequate cause for the stop of a vehicle.
Sure, but then you've got to justify keeping it after the warning ticket is issued, right?
And the period of time between when the warning ticket was issued at approximately 12:06 on the video until 12:54 on the video, when Trooper Owen asked for Defendant Bueno's consent to go ask Flores some questions, that's less than a minute.
He didn't need. Well, you're talking about the supposed consent to keep Bueno in custody, right?
Detained. Yes.
In the front seat of the police car. You surely don't think that Bueno felt free to walk away, do you?
From the indications from the video, as well as his statements, he indicated a few times, about three times, within approximately 15 seconds, that he didn't mind Trooper Owen going to ask Flores some questions.
Sure, come on. The trooper never told him you're free to go.
He never said that.
Feel free to go if the police officer had you seated in the police car and said, you don't mind if you just wait here a few minutes, do you? Would you feel free to walk away?
I haven't been in that position myself, but what I have to go on is the record here, which indicates on video that Defendant Bueno consented to that. And it was soon after that, minutes later, that Flores consented to the search of his van. He first consented verbally and then in writing. And within a minute after that, the canine drug dog was brought out and gave a positive indication for narcotic speed in the van. Beyond this, Bueno lacked standing to challenge the search because he did not have a reasonable expectation in the vehicle of privacy in the vehicle or in the packages. While being questioned by Trooper Owen, he indicated it was not his van, it was not his business, and the packages were not his in the van. He likened his role as an employee and compared it to Federal Express as a delivery service. I'm going to move on to Defendant Gonzalez-Zavala, if the court has no further questions on Defendant Bueno. The district court correctly determined that Defendant Gonzalez-Zavala's advisory range was the level of life imprisonment, which what it was. The defendant admitted at his plea hearing and in his PSR that he maintained a premises for cocaine distribution. He admitted that first at the guilty plea hearing, and then as indicated also at the PSR, that he maintained premises at Joliet and in Plainfield for the purposes of the distribution of cocaine. Additionally, the defendant engaged in the offense as a part of a criminal livelihood. He entered the conspiracy in 2007, and he was a part of that until June of 2009. For the last approximately 7 months of that period, he was the leader of the Chicago operations of the drug distribution network. Additionally, the district court did not rely on clearly erroneous facts in this case. The court did not err in finding that the letters that were submitted by the defendant's wife in Mexico did not militate in favor of leniency. The defendant here agrees that the letters were subject to multiple interpretations including that which was found by the district court. And additionally, the defendant did not dispute the court's interpretations of the letter at the sentencing hearing when the court imposed sentence. So with that, if the court has no further questions, the government...
On that last point, if I could just ask you, Mr. Owens, you're saying he didn't dispute the court's interpretation of the letter. That was part of the judge's explanation of the sentence, right, when the decision had already been made.
Yes,
there's really no obligation to raise an objection at that point, is there?
There's not an obligation to raise one.
Okay. So, I mean, that we either accept the judge, you know, find an abuse of discretion or not with respect to that, but the objection is really irrelevant, right?
I wouldn't say irrelevant. The defendant
There's no obligation to stand up and take exceptions after the district judge has pronounced sentence, right?
However, if the court is making clearly erroneous findings, based on some evidence that you've submitted to the court, you can speak up and correct the court.
You can, but there's no legal consequence for failing to take exception.
No.
Okay.
With that, the government requests that the court affirm the sentence of Gonzalez-Zavala and the order regarding Defendant Bueno. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Owens. Ms. Pavlo?
Respectfully, the record in this case does not show that Mr. Bueno consented on three occasions to remain at the scene. What it does show is that he's sitting in the front seat of a squad car with a drug dog pacing at his back, and according to Trooper Owens' report, which is what the evidence we have to go on in this case, Trooper Owens tells him, I'm going to go investigate further. Hey, would you mind sitting here? He does not feel free to leave at that point. But even if you believe that he did, that consent certainly doesn't extend to being handcuffed, transported to the police station, and continuing a detention when there has been no detection of a crime. The search that was done on the scene, the packages were not opened. There's no recovery of guns, drugs, money, currency, anything. Yet he's detained for a crime that has not yet been detected. There is no link for the collective knowledge doctrine in this case. It's simply not there. It would be an issue that would be litigated at a hearing, and in this case, the district court erred, we believe, in failing to grant a hearing. Thank you.
Ms. Rollins?
I just wanted to return to two of the court's questions from the initial argument. First, the government's burden when the defendant does not raise an objection. I think there is a distinction between not objecting to the pre-sentence report and agreeing to an enhancement as part of a plea agreement. I think the government does have a higher burden when it has not agreed to an enhancement, when the defendant has not agreed to an enhancement as part of the plea agreement, and this is just first raised in the pre-sentence report. And going to the court's question on essentially harmless error, did the district court make enough of a record without respect to the criminal livelihood? I think that whole issue of what Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala received as his participation in this case is essential to the district court's sentencing decision. The district court opened with his commentary about the common law wife in Mexico and the fact that Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala did not provide for that family despite them living in poverty. And we dispute that interpretation, and I think the criminal livelihood enhancement also goes to that issue of really what did Mr. Gonzalez-Zavala receive, and given that the district court relied on its interpretation that he received a lot and did not provide for his family, I think any error does deserve reversal on plain error.
Thank you.
Our
thanks to all counsel. Ms. Pavlov and Mr. Mullins, you have the additional